They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Sarah Kustok is here in studio. Yes Network Nets analyst, FS1 national NBA analyst, and she joins me again here on the podcast. Sarah, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's always an honor. And I feel like when I'm not, I don't speak with you and see you weekly. I miss you, Mannix. So thanks for having me back on.
I miss you as well. Just not being around those. I'm actually not around the Nets as much because of my disdain for Grady more than anything else.
Is that why we don't see you?
Yeah.
I should thank Grady. I should send my gratitude towards Grady for not seeing you
gratitude.
Quite as much.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Now we've gone complete 180 there. I appreciate that.
The truth comes out quick.
We're going to get into the Nets a little bit later in the show. A reminder, subscribe, rate, review this podcast over at Apple Podcast. We come out every week, and that certainly helps a lot. But before we get to your side of the street, Sarah, to use a boxing phrase, let's talk about the Knicks a little bit, who finally cut ties with David Fizdale. That was inevitable. The Knicks have been bad all season. They started to look laughably bad in the last couple of games, some bad losses to Milwaukee and to Denver. That was the last straw for David Fizdale. They fire him. They replace him with Mike Miller, longtime, you know, kind of basketball junkie, former G League coach of the year. He takes over. They look kind of inspired in lost Indiana. Then they go back and get pasted by Portland. They wind up getting a win on the road against the also woebegone Golden State Warriors, but here we are with the Knicks. And I guess let's address the Fizdale stuff. How much of where the Knicks are right now, in your mind, was David Fizdale's fault?
I think an extremely small percentage. And as you know, being in New York, so not being within the organization, but being around it and talking to many folks around it, you have a decent feel. You never know unless you're there every day and on a daily basis and what goes on behind the scenes. However, there's a lot of things you look at in terms of roster construction and personnel that he was dealing with and the circumstances of just how that all played out that I think very little in terms of record or in terms of play falls on David Fizdale, but in many cases responsibility has to fall somewhere, and that's where the organization felt like. And I think just speaking of streets and on the other side of the streets, in the streets, I think we kind of heard and saw the whispers and the writing on the wall that he was on the hot seat, and that was the direction it was going. So I think just inevitably with players, and there was a little bit of a more energy, if you would call it that, when the change was made. I think that always seems to happen with players or with any teams, just whether it's a little bit of a wake-up call or a little bit of a change. I don't think it's so much a reflection on, you know, the past head coach or what happened. I just think anytime there's a change, there's a bit of a burst in energy. But with all that being said, I think very little in what was taking place had to do with David Fizdale. I think he'll get another job. I think he's a reputable head coach that did his best there in that circumstance and in the situation, who I do think will get another opportunity here in the league.
Yeah, look, I don't want to completely absolve Fizdale here because, look, this is his second head coaching job that's ended early in his second season. I mean, those to me are some red flags. Now, the circumstances are different in Memphis. He couldn't get along with Marc Gasol, and that was a big reason that ended the way it did. And in New York, this thing is a whole mess. So that certainly was a factor.
Two very different situations. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it hasn't gotten out of year two. I mean, that has to be noted here. And look, when you're in a position where you're coaching a young team, you've got to be adept at coaching young players. And I don't think Fizdale distinguished himself there either. I mean, I don't know what the hell happened with Kevin Knox in year two. I mean, year one, he's averaging like 30 minutes per game. He's scoring in double figures. He's playing a prominent role in the rotation, 75 games. You know, this year, he was in and out of the lineup. His numbers have plummeted. Now, part of that is roster construction, too. I mean, Kevin Knox found himself in a numbers game with a bunch of forwards there, but I do think David Fizdale has some responsibility when it comes to the devolution, for lack of a better word, of Kevin Knox. All that being said, I agree with the greater premise. I mean, this is a top-down problem in New York, and I think it begins with the roster construction. The Knicks struck out on the top-tier free agents, and they went out, and I thought they did a smart thing in not tying themselves to too many players on long-term, really anybody on long-term contracts, but they went out and signed a bunch of guys to play the same position. That has had a trickle-down effect on Kevin Knox. Mitchell Robinson has played a different role this year with that team. They have been committed to playing Julius Randle for some reason for as many minutes as they are, and I think that's been a big part of the problem. They also didn't supply David Fizdale with a credible point guard. I mean, Dennis Smith has been pretty bad this year. Frank Ntilikina has been bad, then good,
Mannix,
then bad.
They went into the season not knowing who their point guard was. Like, to me, that's an issue. You just brought up what I think is the most important position on a team, and there was question marks from the preseason to heading into training camp, and question, you know, so with Dennis Smith Jr., Frank Ntilikina, what's Elfrid Payton going to get? I mean, that, like, to me, and I would say that's accurate, that part of that is the head coaching, the coaching staff, and that decision on that. But there seemed to be so much unclarity of those roles and who you are anticipating in that position. And going back, like, the Julius Randle in the minutes, but he was their marquee free agent signing. So there was expectation. I mean, I feel like we're going into the season saying, oh, could he potentially make a run at an all-star bid if the Knicks, you know, have a bit of a resurgence? So that's where, to me...
Did you really believe Julius Randle was going to make a run at an
all-star bid? I don't know. I always... I push for things in the preseason. No, but I'm saying that was... There was conversation out there about that. So I guess my point is, what do you expect when you have six power forwards on the roster? I mean, you've got so much loaded in that position or at the front court, and you bring up Mitchell Robinson. He's a player that should be a really bright spot and have a lot of upside on that team. I think it's all a bit of a mess, and I think there's so many questions marks surrounding that with the young players, with some of the veterans you bring in. What are you bringing these veterans in for? Is it for leadership? Is it for experience? I think there's a lot to try and wade through, and because of that, you're right. The head coach, there's always some responsibility, but I'm not sure that I would put most of it on Fizdale.
No, and look, you can't win in this league without a high-level point guard. You just can't. You have to have a high-level point guard, or you have to have every other position stocked so your point guard could just be a caretaker. And, you know, the Knicks thought Dennis Smith might be the guy. He's not. Ntilikina has had multiple opportunities to kind of seize that role. He hasn't. I remember, you know, talking about preseason predictions. Remember when Elfrid Payton was supposed to be the guy to take over and kind of stabilize that position? He didn't do that. So, you know, without that position squared away, it's tough to figure it out. I guess look, whatever happens this season, they're going to be bad. I mean, they'll be bottom five bad in this league, and Mike Miller probably be gone, but it almost doesn't matter what happens with that coaching box, Sarah, unless James Dolan gets it. Unless he gets that to run a 21st century functional franchise, you have to go out there and, you know, put aside personal preference when it comes to your front office, you know, guys that you want there, and hire the best guy available. And we're already hearing about, well, Masai Ujiri's the guy that they really want. We've been hearing that for multiple years in New York. But you're not going to get Masai Ujiri as long as you continue to be wed to having guys like Steve Mills around. And look, I'm not the type of guy, Sarah, that advocates for firings. I think that's a little too glib at times, and we get a little too gung-ho on firing people. But Steve Mills has been around for decades, like literally decades, within that organization in various roles. He is not cut out to be a basketball operations guru, or even really involved in basketball operations. It's not going to change there until James Dolan gets it. So I guess the only question is this the offseason that James Dolan finally gets it and runs this franchise the way it needs to be run?
I don't have the answer to that, nor do I think anyone really does, short of James Dolan and what he wants and what his expectations for this franchise are going to be. And that, you know, just in a small sample size with, or example, with the Nets and seeing, you know, I lived through the years of Mikhail Prokhorov and some of his thoughts, his push, his desires with Billy King to be integrated with the decision making and what he wanted in trying to get a quick fix for a championship, and then learning that that way and that route did not work. And so his hiring of Sean Marks and part of Sean Marks taking over was predicated on the fact that Marks wanted decision-making power and some autonomy and authority over who he was going to hire, and whether it was dealing with the head coach and the coaching staff or the performance team or just decisions based on personnel and who he was going to bring in. In everything, the culture we look at in Brooklyn now and the way in things changed and did so in a quick manner was because of that, and because of the, you know, Prokhorov saying, okay, go and run with this. I'm going to trust the basketball minds that I put into place there. And so with James Dolan, I don't know. And it would also be, for example, with the Masai Ujiri, you know, the speculations on that and talk about that. And I know that's something that's been ongoing, but just using him hypothetically as an example, the trust that if that's what you say, if you're taking the trust that that's what will happen, that you will be able to make those type of decisions, you will be able to run with what you think, you know, throughout the course of a big picture plan and a long-term plan. And I'm not sure, you know, that that's something that's a decision for, of course, James Dolan, but also that person that's going to have to trust in taking that role, that that's how things will go.
Unless you're going to offer Masai Ujiri that complete autonomy, he's never going to take it. He is not going to accept a job that comes with any kind of, you know, contingencies that says you
and
have
that's,
to keep
and that's
this
where
guy
I think
in this role.
When you ask, does he get it right this summer? To me, that's what getting it right is, giving that autonomy to whatever person that it is that you're trusting to hire and allowing them to have full control over basketball operations. And I don't know, I don't know James Dolan, so I have no idea. However, you know, that seems like the natural next step of getting it right. How do you get it right? Put someone that you believe has the basketball mind and savvy and understanding of this league in that position, and then let them have control.
Yeah, and look, they haven't been willing to do that, they being the Knicks and James Dolan, in the recent past. I mean, you know, ESPN had a good TikTok of the Knicks of the last year or so, or even further, and one of the things they wrote about was David Griffin, when he was interviewing for that job, it became clear to him that he wouldn't have total control, that Steve Mills would have to be involved in some way. That was a deal breaker for David Griffin when it came to that job. It'll be a deal breaker for any top level GM that is going to be interested in that job. They want their own people and the ability to overhaul an organization that, quite frankly, needs to be overhauled at this point. Look, I said this on a recent podcast. I don't like Knicks fans looking for hope. There's none. Like, there's no reason to be optimistic that this team can turn it around in the next 5 years. I mean, RJ Barrett is a nice young player and could turn out to be a kind of a franchise tentpole player. But in the next 5 years, RJ Barrett and what? Like, the Knicks have already shown they cannot land a free agent. They had cap space. They had a high draft pick. They had what was viewed as a player-friendly coach in Fizdale and a savvy general manager in Scott Perry, and they couldn't lure a top-tier free agent. So without that ability, where are they? Like, I don't look at this landscape in New York and say right now there's a reason within 5 years they're going to be good. Forget Masai Ujiri. He's not come without autonomy. Forget Giannis. I mean, that is dumb. Anyone believing the Giannis talk right now has to be deep down the Knicks rabbit hole here. There is, to me, no reason to be optimistic about their future. I just don't have it. I can't objectively say there's something out there that gives me hope for them. I mean, can you see anything in the next 5 years that gives you reason to believe?
No, but that's this but Knicks the team? But the thing, the way I look at it and the way they operate, and you could draw some similarities or comparisons to the Lakers, other than the fact that the Lakers got LeBron James, they got Anthony Davis. Is it about the next 5 years? Like, it feels like a strategy and a process going through, like the approach every offseason is set up as though they will get free agents and then they don't. And so if you look at a long, if you look at a 5 year plan, I mean, that's why things take time. If you're not landing some of the bigger free agents, and in order to land those free agents, we've seen, and the landscape of the NBA has changed, and the infrastructure matters to free agents and what you are bringing to the table and the way they look at whether it's the president of basketball ops or the GM or the team or the coaches or the core. Guys care about that because they understand it takes more than just one star to contend for a title. And so they want to see that all of that is in place. I still believe that the lure, I think things have changed how you look at the Knicks. I still believe the lure of New York City, the lure of Madison Square Garden, I still think that can exist. But without the proper infrastructure of an organization or of the franchise, that doesn't weigh heavily enough to help bring players to that organization.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I also want to know what the NBA office thinks about this and, you know, if there's anything they can do about it. I mean, probably not, because you can't force an owner to sell a team, especially not James Dolan, especially not one that spends money. It's not like you're dealing with an owner that's actively trying to lose games, but this is right in their backyard. I know it embarrassed David Stern in his tenure. I would imagine it's the same way with Adam Silver.
Well, it would be an extraordinary thing for the NBA in general to, if the New York Knicks are a good contending basketball team, that is an excellent thing for the NBA. It's great for everyone. It's great for fans. It's great for the league. It would be a great thing. So that's, of course, something that I think everyone would like to rectify.
Yeah, and we haven't seen it this century. Like, literally this century. There was, like, one season in the last, you know, 19 years that the Knicks
were quasi-contenders. They had a winning season. Kids last year. What was that, 2012? 12-13?
Something like one of 11-12? One of the Melo years.
Melo was there. Kids last year before he retired. They were a playoff team.
Okay, I said 1 year. There was 1 year in that collection of in the last 20. I mean, not since they went to the finals back in, what was it, 99, have we seen that be the case. I don't know. It's frustrating watching the Knicks operate, because a team with that kind of resources, and ask any player in the league, where do they most like to play?
Well,
like,
and that's what I mean.
75%+ will say the Garden.
It's still a magic place. It's still a magical place.
Yes. Well, not so much the home team these days, but we'll see if that'll change. All right, let's go out to the West Coast for a second. One of the biggest surprises this year has been just how good the Lakers are. They're on, as we speak, a 5-game winning streak. They are only lost once technically in December, but they have gone on the road to Denver, to Utah, to Orlando, to Portland, and won road games. This was the month, Sarah, that I thought the Lakers' mettle would be tested and we'd see what they really are. And so far, so good with this Laker team. Now, they are on a road trip right now that's going to take them through Miami. Indiana's tough. They finish in Milwaukee, but right now, the Lakers are looking like the real deal. Tell me, from what you've seen, what's the biggest surprise to you about the way the Lakers are playing?
I don't know if I could pick one thing. There has been a multitude of things that have been a surprise. Just how well they've gelled and come together in the chemistry this early on. I anticipated that we would be talking about the Lakers and contending for a title and what they would be at the latter part of the season once they figured it out and came together and got used to Frank Vogel and he settled in with the coaching staff. And there were so many new pieces and new parts and moving parts that I think with any NBA team, you'd give them a little bit of latitude of, okay, it's going to take some time. They had a 14-1 November. And even in, I don't even care about when people were talking about the softer schedule. It's not always easy to win all the games you should win. I think their defense, if you would have told me they would have been one of the top defenses in the league, even though they have Anthony Davis anchoring that, I'm not sure I would have believed you. The fact that everyone has been the best version of themselves. I mean, the shooting, they're getting Danny Green coming in, Avery Bradley, what he's doing defensively, Rondo and Caruso. I mean, the fact they've weathered through some injuries at different, everyone's kind of missed a little bit of time here and there, and they sustain this level of play. You would have assumed that LeBron James and Anthony Davis would be a great match and a great fit together, but how quickly they have been just an exceptionally extraordinary duo, and continuing to be peaking and in the way their level of play has elevated each other. I mean, LeBron James, I feel like the way he's empowered everyone else in their own roles, I could keep going on and on, but and I do. I think a lot of credit goes towards Frank Vogel and how he's figured out the best way to really implement this defensive mindset and mentality of these guys, how everyone is brought in, the preparation that he has come with. I just think everything as a whole, just how quickly this team that we anticipated may come together towards the end of the season has already been showing these flashes of brilliance this early on in a sustained manner. I did not anticipate this to happen, and it's been really fun to watch.
Yeah, I've been a big, you know, Frank Vogel guy for a long time. I've thought he's
is he a podcast regular? Is he one of your podcast regulars?
He has been a, let's call him a acquaintance of the podcast.
Okay.
I don't know if we call him quite yet a friend, but he's been an acquaintance of the podcast, been a guest a couple of times. I think he's an excellent coach. I thought that what happened in Orlando was less about him than circumstance there. His boss is getting fired after the first year. It just threw everything into flux, and he's proven out to be the right man to have this job. I think the biggest surprise to me about the Lakers is the shooting. I mean, they're a top 5 3-point shooting team. Who would have thought coming into this season that the Lakers would be that good? They're shooting right around 37% from 3-point range. That's incredible. Like, the Lakers as a top 5 3-point shooting team, that they're almost unbeatable if they play up to that level offensively, because they're good at every other facet. I mean, they're great at the pick and roll with LeBron and AD there. They've got solid defenders, obviously. Dwight Howard's been much better than expected at that middle position. I mean, that's been that to me is like the biggest glaring scary number for teams to look at when it comes to the Lakers, that they can shoot that well and be successful on the season. LeBron
because being a two-way I was going to say, because they get easy points everywhere else. Like, they're going to get points off turnovers. They're going to get second chance points. They're going to get out on the break. So yeah, that's an excellent point. The fact that they're actually efficiently knocking down 3-point shots. Yeah, and keep going.
And LeBron as a two-way player has been incredibly surprising too. I mean, you figured coming in he was going to continue to be this offensive machine, but he is having his best defensive season in years. I mean, he is. I don't know if it's just, you know, the way that the defense is schemed, or more likely a stronger commitment to the defensive end of the floor. But
Anthony
Davis
out there, I think certainly helps.
Yeah, no, there's no question. I mean, he seems to have embraced this idea that he's the washed king. I don't know where this came from, because I don't know anyone that has called him washed up. I mean, I think people have suggested, you know, based on the eyeball test and the numbers, that he's not as good a defensive player as he's been in years past. But
and I think that was a conscious decision. But no. And I think that defensively, that was a little bit of a conscious decision in past years, to maybe pick and choose his spots of when he needed to exert the most energy. So I don't think his defensive game was necessarily lacking because he couldn't physically do it. I think it was more a for lack of a better term, like load managing. I think maybe Brian Windhorst at times had said this throughout the course of last season or at some point, like the chosen load management within game of maybe a possession here, possession there, you catch a little bit more of a breath. I don't think anyone did. I think the only thing, we hadn't seen him injured before, you know, before last season. We hadn't seen him miss that amount of time with injury, and we hadn't seen him miss out on a playoff. But I think most people, from my understanding and thought coming into this season, looked at that as a silver lining and a positive of, we are going to get, even though the fact that he is the age he is and the minutes and the miles that he has accumulated throughout the course of his career, and especially playing throughout the course of the number of postseasons and final appearances, that we would get the most refreshed LeBron James that we had seen in some time. And I feel like that's what we've got.
Yeah, and I think he sees an opportunity here. You know, the NBA's opened up no super team anymore. He's got Anthony Davis, and he, I think he sees that if he plays at an extremely high level, you know, the Miami-type LeBron, that this team can win a championship, that it's that open in the NBA this season. And he's jumped on it, and he's played up to levels that we haven't seen in a long time. Now, to keep him at that level, I think the Lakers have to have an internal discussion here. And I had this argument recently on TV with our friend Nick Wright about the ideas that about the Lakers.
You and Nick got embracing, into an argument? Shocker.
Yeah, I know. A Laker debate with Nick was, it always happens. But the idea that the Lakers should embrace load management. I mean, I know fans hate it. A lot of players hate it. Coaches hate it. But you are talking about LeBron, who in a few weeks is going to be, I believe, 35 years old. People say he's not playing. He's playing a career low in minutes. That is true technically, but he's still right around 35 minutes per game. So it's not like he's in the, you know, high 20s
right.
in minutes per game. He's still playing a significant role. In your mind, should the Lakers take on some kind of load management philosophy when it comes to LeBron and Anthony Davis, who has been dealing with a shoulder problem throughout the course of the season?
Speaking of getting into heated arguments with people, I feel like offline and off record, I've had a lot of conversations, and whether it's in regards to Kawhi or other players, I just so strongly believe that everyone, especially some of these individuals and players that we're talking about, at this point in their careers, know their bodies. And I don't think there should be any push by those other than the individuals themselves and their training staff or performance team or athletic training staff, however you want to term it, to make assessments on how guys should handle management and load management. And I know whether we want to talk about TV ratings or what's good for the game or fans, or I know there's a lot of other extraneous factors that go into this and why people have strong opinions about it. But it, like these guys, they pour their heart and soul into what they're doing and how they're playing and what they're doing professionally. And so, no, I think they know. I think for as much as we can look at that with LeBron James or Anthony Davis or just the better run of the season or going to the, I think guys know their bodies. I think if same thing goes with Kawhi, I think whatever they feel most comfortable doing and how they believe it will help them throughout the course of a season. Like LeBron, this isn't his first rodeo. He's been through this before. I know he's not been through it before at this age, but I think that he will have a gauge and a feel on what he needs to do. And for some people and somebody, it is better for them to stay in a rhythm and stay playing and stay in condition and stay in game shape and do so by being in games. So, I mean, I think we'll see what happens, and I think that very well could be what factors in. And I think towards the end of the season or the last month or whenever coming after the All-Star break, that may be a part of what they do with LeBron and with AD. But I don't think there should be some mandate or some structure necessarily if it's not in accordance of what they think is best for their bodies.
Look, I see both sides of this argument, and there are ways to quote load manage guys without missing games. You can certainly scale back what you do in practice, which is what we've seen happen with LeBron and the Lakers and even the Cavaliers before. You can also, you know, pull them out of games early and keep their minutes in some of these games down into the, you know, low to mid 20s. And that's the equivalent of kind of taking a night off to some guys. But I would say I don't think it's a good thing for the Lakers' playoff chances if LeBron plays 80 plus games. And I don't expect him to.
And I don't expect him to play that much, but I don't think that you need to say, oh, he needs to be at 65 or, you know, 70.
No.
Who knows? Who knows? But I also, if that's where LeBron feels like his body is going to be, it's a steady upcline. I mean, I think we see him more. Sometimes he eases his way, feels his way out a little bit into a season, and we haven't seen that this year with him. So I think it just circles back to, I think he will have the best gauge on how, what point he needs to be at with his body. And that I don't think any of us can speculate what is optimal for him to do and how that will work best throughout the course of thinking about a playoff run.
Oh, that's what we do, though, Sarah. We speculate on what guys should do. We tell them what they should do, right?
I know.
In our position.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to. I'm going to take a hard pass on that.
We just put on our coaching hat and our general manager hat and medical hat even and start advising guys left and right. But, yeah, we'll see. Load management has become one of those hot-button topics that people seem to have strong opinions on one way or the other. All right, let's talk about the trade deadline. And still a couple of months away, but we are days away from sort of the unofficial start of trade season when players who are signed in the offseason can be moved. It generally doesn't lead to immediate trades after, you know, mid-December, but it starts to pick up, I think, a lot of the chatter around the NBA. And there already is some chatter around a few players. One in particular I want to get into, and that's Kevin Love, who is, you know, basically marooned on Cavaliers Island out there where it is just a dysfunctional mess in Cleveland. John Boeheim, I'm sure Boeheim, nice guy, but I never thought that was going to work. You take a college coach in his 60s and you put him into this situation. It just doesn't seem to be working out all that well in Cleveland. There was a long story in The Athletic about it recently about how guys are feeling about the way Boeheim is coaching. Meanwhile, you got Love, who is in the second year of a long-term contract, making good money, $30-plus million on this deal. But, you know, I think the Cavaliers, as has been reported, are open to moving him. The question I have is, what kind of difference can Kevin Love make on a contending team? Do you look at Kevin Love as being a piece that could help a team win a championship, or are his weaknesses, which is the defensive end of the floor, and he's already past 30 at this point, and he's had some history of injuries, is he too big a risk for a contending team to give up anything real to go and get? What's your view on Kevin Love as a trade target?
I do think that's a... I think if you just want to generally ask the question, can he make a difference, make an impact on a championship contending team, I would unequivocally say yes. I think he can be a piece. I can think he can make an impact. I know you mentioned the age, but he's still 31 years old. I don't think he has a ton of wear and tear on his body. And I think some of, you know, the season, he's been in and out a little bit. His numbers, his rebounding numbers are still up. Shooting numbers are solid. I think you factor in the circumstance and situation he's in, the motivation that comes or may not come from playing in a, what, 5-19 or so team, you know, one of the bottom teams in the league in Cleveland. So I think you would get a Kevin Love that would be impactful. But he, you mentioned the numbers, the contract, it's 3 years, $90 million. And so what you would be willing to give up, I think, becomes a question. And I think there's a balance there. I also think for Cleveland, I mean, I'm not sure with them, but I don't think they're probably hard prepped. Maybe they're open to listening to, you know, what teams would be willing to offer, but doesn't, I don't think they're hard pressed to move him by, you know, the trade deadline, or, you know, they could wait until this summer. And so I think it becomes a question of, you know, what exactly your need is. And I think Kevin Love still can bring that shooting ability to stretch you out to the table. I think his rebounding factor and ability to get after the offensive glass as well. Like, I think there are some teams that could be in need of that. I think the question mark becomes, how much are you willing to give up, given the fact that it's not just for this year? It's not an expiring deal. It's, you know, it's, you got a couple of years left, which you may look at as a positive that, you know, you'll have him around for a while. But then the age comes into play where, you know, how is that going to factor in the next few years? I think he for sure is a piece that for some teams, they'd probably look at him thinking that he can be the one thing that helps put them over the edge of being a team that can contend, especially given how wide open the NBA is this season.
Yeah, I think the issue with Kevin Love, I don't think it's the money he's making over the next few years. One thing about Kevin is that he has kept himself in just pristine condition over the course of his playing career. I mean, he is one of the best conditioned athletes in the NBA. And look, injuries happen, and you can't really predict them, but you know Kevin Love is going to be in tip-top shape.
Well, in the injuries, correct me if I'm wrong, it's like a broken hand or a fit, like it's...
Yeah,
it's not injuries that seem to be where they'll be nagging, but continue on.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's not like he's got some kind of regressive injury that is going to be problematic for a team naturally moving forward. I also don't think that acquiring him, I don't think teams are too worried about the contract. I mean, $30 million, give or take, is a lot of money, but it's kind of the going rate for like a star level player these days. I mean, you just saw what Philadelphia gave Al Horford in the offseason. Al Horford is going to be in his like late 30s by the time that contract is up, and Kevin Love's only going to be, what, like 34 by the time his contract is up. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue right now, based on the people I've talked to around the league, is that the Cavaliers actually want something back in return. And I'm not sure that there seems to be a disconnect in some of the teams that are interested in Kevin Love. They'll give up expiring contracts, but they're not willing to give up any kind of real asset back in return. The Cavaliers are still holding out for a real asset, whether that's a draft pick or a young player. They want something back in exchange for Kevin Love. And I think that's going to keep Kevin Love around for the foreseeable, unless something changes significantly one way or the other. I think that's going to keep Kevin Love around. But look, I think there are teams Kevin Love can make an immediate impact on? Absolutely. I can give you two right off the bat. I look at Portland. If I'm the Blazers, go get Kevin Love. I mean, they have tied themselves to this core through like 2025. Like, they're locked in on Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum. They're going to get Jusuf Nurkić back probably sometime in February or March. Kevin Love would be a nice compliment to Nurkić.
Do you think anything changes? Do you think the Carmelo Anthony pickup changes that at all, or changes the need for Kevin Love at all?
No, because look, Kevin Love is, he's a better player than Carmelo. Like, he's a more consistent, reliable three-point shooter. And look, Carmelo's been a nice story, but if push comes to shove, you can always cut Carmelo. And, you know, he's only making the veteran minimum. I know they guaranteed his contract, but who cares? Like, if you have to make a choice there, you choose Kevin Love because he's just a better, I think he's clearly a better player at this stage of his career. So if you're the Blazers, go and get him. Like, if it's, you know, a Hassan Whiteside contract, even if you put in some kind of sweetener, if it comes to a first round pick, Kevin Love could open your window. We talked about the Lakers sensing a window. If you're the Blazers, who were a conference finals team last year, there's a window for you to win if you go and get a Kevin Love. The other team I would look at, I kind of think Toronto's interesting. No, I mean, you know, the Raptors have a whole bunch of expiring contracts, and I don't know if they're a championship team. They've kind of hit some hard times over the last week. Siakam maybe is feeling the burden of being the number one guy, but they're getting healthy. I mean, Lowry's back, Ibaka's back. I mean, they've got some guys. They've got a championship core still sort of quasi intact without Kawhi Leonard. If you can get Kevin Love without giving up too much, that's another team that I think could be really interesting for Love moving forward.
Toronto confuses me in a really positive way, because they're far exceeding what I thought they would look like this year. Pascal Siakam, we knew he would come back and be very good, but he has been just excellent. And you're right, they've got the group, they've got the piece. I just continue to wonder what direction will they head, how will they look the next few weeks. And you mentioned Lowry coming back. Like, is Lowry a piece that stays there? Are they continuing to stick with him with this extension? Do they use that? You know, would they ever consider trading him? I'm curious to watch just from a fan side, because I'm such a big fan of a lot of the young pieces and the group they've structured together, what they do with it and what they continue.
You can't dump Kyle Lowry on Cleveland. You just can't. That's just mean.
No, not Lowry to Cleveland. I'm just saying get multiple teams involved. Would Lowry go to Minnesota? Like, I keep hearing Minnesota and their need for it. Would that be a piece that there's, I'm not saying just a straight up two team trade with them. Lowry, no, they would not put him in Cleveland. I'm just curious to see big picture Toronto, what their plan is moving forward. And do they continue to push, and do they continue to add on pieces and say, let's continue to make another run at this? Or do they start thinking about the future and kind of laying things out in a different respect? I don't know. Those are things I don't know about Toronto, but like I said, they far exceeded what I thought that they would look like this season. It's been fun to watch what they've done. What about
are you with me? Are you with me though on Portland?
Like, yeah, I'm with you on Portland. I'm with you on Toronto because I love what Toronto's doing. I'm with you on Portland. I would toss out another team that I'm just, again, another team. The teams I'm thinking about are teams that have kind of been at another level of what I thought they would be coming into the season. Miami is one of those teams. And I'm not sure what they would be willing to part with or give up. I'm not sure what it would take for Cleveland to do a deal with them. But I think Miami, which I know we'll get to some of our surprise contenders, they're a team who I look at and I'm like, oh, would they look to make one more move, or would they look to make, you know, a move or two to put them in a different place than they'd be at, considering how well they've been playing and how well they fit together. And so they were another team that crossed my mind about, ooh, Kevin Love would be a good fit with them. It's just about what they would be willing to part with and what Cleveland would want to make it work.
Yeah,
Houston. I'm just hung up on you into Houston?
No, I mean, what do you give up? Like, at some point, you have to look at what you have to offer. And Miami is just, they would take on anyone with a big name. Like, they just believe in acquiring talent and their ability down there to integrate said talent into their group. And
because what they haven't had is 3-point shoot. Like, they've struggled with 3-point shoot. I mean, they've got a lot of excellent pieces, and they've got some guys who have been good, but to add a stretch four, and especially alongside Bam Adebayo and the way that he's been playing, like that, I just look at that and I'm like, okay, they could use him. Again, goes back, what would they give up? Who would they give up? How would that change the dynamic and the complexion of the roster? But
yeah, I just don't know what, I mean, Miami, like, I think if anybody, they're a threat for Chris Paul as much as anybody else.
I also think, circling back to your original suggestion, the fact that Portland would be going back home for Kevin Love, a place that he would want to play at, and not to say he wouldn't want to be at the other places, but that always adds a little bit of something if you know that you're sending a guy on both sides to a place that, you know, that is probably his number one choice. And especially a guy like Kevin Love, who's done what he's done for Cleveland.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it might come down to with Portland is, like, how deep into the well do you go to get him? Like, they have, you know, they've got Hassan Whiteside's contract, which could eat up the bulk of any kind of money matching in the deal. But, I mean, do you go
Zach
with draft
Collins?
Picks? I mean, you know, Zach Collins is out there as a trade chip, but I don't know if I'd trade Zach Collins.
I really like Zach Collins. I know. I like Zach Collins, and I'm bummed about his injury because he looked good to start the year.
I wouldn't want to give him up. Like, even he's such a big part of their future. Now, do you sacrifice the future for the presence? If you think Kevin Love is the difference in a championship there or not. But I'll tell you what, Nurkic, Love, McCollum, Lillard, that's a tough team. That is a really tough team to beat in any conference. That, I think that would instantly make the Blazers a legitimate contender. And that's a team that needs an injection of something right now to make it all work.
And that's where you factor in your timeline and what is your timeline. And when you've got guys like Dame and CJ, that, not to say it expedites your timeline, but you're thinking more, what do we need to do now and in the next few years? And that's where Kevin Love can be seen as a great fit.
Yeah,
in terms of being able to give up some of those future assets.
Yeah, it creates a window, and you know, who knows how long that window is going to be open. Like, the window for everybody could be like a year, because like Golden State's going to add like a top three pick this year. I mean, it's incredible. Like, this is like, I mean, I'm sure the Warriors, you know, hate to see their guys get injured, but next year they're going to come back with Steph, Clay, Draymond, and like James Wiseman as the starting center with that group. It's surreal watching what's happening right now. I mean, when the Warriors got beat by the Knicks, I kind of tweeted out there, I'm like, this is really happening, huh? Like, the Warriors going to win like 11 games. It's like the Spurs when they added Duncan while still having Robinson.
And then they're going to come back and be monsters.
Yeah, like the super team is going to be reconstituted next fall because they got James Wiseman or somebody like that with that group. All right, let's just talk for a minute about some of these surprise contenders that are out there. You kind of hinted at Miami there, so give me your biggest surprise contender of the season.
Miami, I would hint at, and I more think about contention for the East. although my top is still Milwaukee, that whole bunch. But if I was thinking about surprises, Miami was a big surprise. But more than anything, like if you want to talk about an actual, if I'm going to have to place a bet on a surprise contender other than those that we've discussed ad nauseum, the Dallas Mavericks. Like I could see, get them in the playoffs, and who knows what would happen with a guy like Luka. And I'm not just jumping on the Doncic bandwagon. He was one of my favorite players to watch last year, but he has blown my mind with how he looks here in his second year. I think Kristaps Porzingis is going to continue to get healthier, continue to get more just comfortable and acclimated. Rick Carlisle is just given his expertise, given what he understands, how they're doing, but I never would have imagined that they would be this efficient offensively. And so you just look down the line, the playoffs, they don't turn the ball over a lot. I mean, they're a team that I would keep an eye on if you want to talk about maybe a dark horse. It's early in the season, but they've been in my mind just one of the biggest wow surprises.
Yeah, that Luka Porzingis pick and whatever, roll, pop, slide, whatever you want to do with them, that could turn out to be one of the most devastating in league history just because of how versatile both those guys
yes.
are.
Yes, and I do. Incredible. I think by nature, when guys come back from injury and Porzingis playing now for the first time, like I just always, as we've seen with so many players, it takes time, even if they are healthy. And so I think by once we get even further and deeper into March, and given what Luka's going to be able to do and continue to do, I think they're just, I mean, it's nasty already, but I think it's just gonna continue to get better and better. And I think we need to watch out for Dallas later on in the year.
Yeah, and I'm going to say Indiana for my surprise team because let me tell you, I was dead wrong about the Pacers in pretty much every possible way this offseason.
What did you say about
fundamentally,
them?
Fundamentally, I kind of sort of shrugged at their offseason moves. I thought they should have found a way to re-sign Bogdanovic. He was so good for them.
Yeah.
When Oladipo went down, then they go out and throw all this money at Malcolm Brogdon.
You didn't
and
like
Brogdon
that?
A nice, like he had a nice playoffs, but you know when I talked to opposing coaches, the thing that came up a bunch was that, you know, Brogdon in Milwaukee, oftentimes he was staring at like the fifth worst defender on that team, or at least the worst perimeter defender, because you devoted your best perimeter defenders to Middleton and to Giannis and. And he oftentimes got a favorable matchup defensively. In Indiana, with Oladipo still down, he would have to face the top guy. And some people I talked to thought he would struggle with that. He hasn't. He has been great. He just carved up the Celtics down the stretch the other night. He was knocking down free throws. He's been really good in that role. I also kind of shrugged at some of the other deals, like T.J. Warren. I was like, all right, whatever, that's fine. You know, Jeremy Lamb I thought was a little bit soft. He's been really good for them. They hit on all these offseason moves, and now they've got a team that when you slide Victor Oladipo back in, whether it's January, February, and if he can find his way back into game shape by April, I think you're looking at a team that could be a real threat in that conference. I'm with you on the top tier is still Milwaukee. I think they're alone right now at the top of the conference. But that second tier is still wide open. Philadelphia still has a lot to prove. They can't win on the road, and they've got some questionable perimeter shooting issues. I think Boston is still flawed with their front court. Indiana's got an opportunity here. If Oladipo could find a way to get back to being like 75% of Oladipo, and while he's stepping into another thing I was wrong about, by the way, was Sabonis and Turner being able to play together. I didn't think that was going to happen.
You weren't the only one. Fine. I think that was a big question, and I think even early on in the season, that was a question mark. And Turner missed some games, and Sabonis was playing, but I don't think you were way off on that, but I really respect the way that they've figured that out, and Nate McMillan, give him credit for that too.
Yeah, I just, and Nate's another guy. I've never been fully warmed up to Nate as a coach, just because when they came, what was it, 2-3 years ago, when they almost beat Cleveland, but tested Cleveland.
They
in the
did.
Playoffs.
They took him to Game 7. I covered that series.
Yeah,
I think he has got a extremely bright basketball mind. I think he gets guys to buy in, like the way that they play, the identity. Everyone knows their roles. Everyone understands what's asked of them. Like I think he does that quickly with the team and with the moving part, like all the guys you mentioned and the new pieces in the roster, and you're like, oh, he's fitting really well. Oh, I didn't anticipate. I think Nate McMillan doesn't get enough credit for reasons like that.
No, he doesn't, and I'm guilty of it. I'm very guilty of not giving him a heck of a lot of credit. And this team, like the rotation players that are there, only two of them right now are back from last year. It's like Sabonis and Turner, and then everybody else is basically new with that group. But they fit in well together. They have had the benefit of a relatively soft schedule, but throw that out. They beat Boston at home, and Boston was on a tear going in. So I got to give them a ton of credit. I'm very anxious to see how Oladipo fits in and exactly how well he's able to play this season. I think he'll get back to being Victor Oladipo, but can he be close to that this year? Because once you put Oladipo in, somebody from that unit goes to the bench, whether it's Warren or somebody else, that will improve their second unit, which has been a weakness for that team this year. On paper, it should make the Pacers a contender. But as we know, paper doesn't always pan out.
And as we know, for as much as even if Victor Oladipo is back in game shape and his condition, like all the stuff, and understandably so, we see coming back from injuries like that with guys, sometimes it takes a beat, and it takes more than just, you know, the last stretch of a season or getting in the play. Like sometimes, again, understandably so, it takes a little bit more time than you would anticipate, even if they're fully healthy, just to catch the rhythm again.
Right. They're going to be a fun team to watch. I hope Oladipo comes back sooner than later so he can start to get some chemistry. But that's a team that has really surprised me.
Surprised me with that pick, and that's I like it. I like your selling points.
Yeah,
yes. I'm in. Grady would be very proud and appreciative.
Whatever. Speaking of Grady and speaking of the Nets, I've got to ask you about what's going on in Brooklyn right now. Playing good basketball without Kyrie, and already I'm reading some stuff.
Can I start the Spencer Dinwiddie All-Star campaign? Can I mark it right here?
I'm
behind the page on that. I want to continue it. I want to keep it going.
But how much? Tell me this. How much of what the Nets are doing are? I mean, we've seen the schedule. It's they've benefited from some easier games on that schedule during the stretch. Kyrie's been out. But what's happened to this team in the absence of Kyrie Irving?
I think, Chris, as you know, and as anyone who watches basketball and with different teams, and that's why even when I was talking about the Lakers and you mentioned the chemistry and them coming together, the Pacers, you could say the same thing. It takes a second for guys to get acclimated with one another and with the style of play and what's being asked of them, the coaching staff. And so I think there's been so much scrutiny and emphasis on, oh wow, look at what these guys have done without Kyrie Irving being in the lineup. And to me, it's less about that, and it's more about just everyone's getting comfortable with one another. Everyone's getting comfortable with their roles. Kenny Atkinson more used to than the rotation, the trust of the new guys. Like Carrot Temple has been a extremely important addition and how he's been playing on both sides of the ball, and it took him a little bit of time to get you. Spencer Dinwiddie, and I say, you know, and I'm sincere about him, but I believe he should be at this point definitely in All-Star conversation, but he didn't have a great start to the season. It took him a little bit of time to get comfortable, and he got comfortable once Kyrie was still playing. It wasn't a matter of just him getting in the starting lineup and Kyrie being out. And so I think all of those factors, Caris LeVert getting injured and just different guys being relied upon, and some of these younger guys that weren't getting minutes and just getting comfortable after a stretch of time when you got eight new guys on a roster. I think that is what's added to when we talk about the ball movement or the assist numbers or just everything that people speculate about it being because of an absence of Kyrie Irving. I think it's just the fact that these guys are getting more used to playing with one another. DeAndre Jordan now has been healthy, and so he's been just a great addition. He's settled in a little bit more to still based on matchup and personnel, but settle into more of that second unit role rather than it being back and forth between him and Jared Allen, the starting lineup. So I think you could look at a multitude of things. But overall, it's just everyone's games have elevated because they've created a better chemistry with one another. Torian Prince, you could toss in there. But I know deep dive into just Nets rotation wise, but I think everyone loves to look at it like, oh, Kyrie's out of the lineup and, you know, everyone's playing better. It's been a product of just everyone getting more comfortable with each other. And when Kyrie Irving is healthy and comes back, when Caris LeVert is healthy and comes back, I think that you're going to see the same thing about the second unit will be fortified because different guys will be moved back in position. I think Kenny Atkinson's going to have a lot of, you know, just challenging in the staff, challenging decisions to make about what they do with the lineup, what they do with Spencer Dinwiddie, where they put him, who they play next to each other. But I do think it's just a matter of a team taking a little bit of time to get comfortable with one another.
Yeah, and a lot of the criticism of Kyrie is unfair. I mean, I was the first one to stand up and say people in Boston are morons who think that Kyrie's like avoiding playing against the Celtics, and that's clearly borne out. He's legitimately hurt with that shoulder injury. It's just kind of it's like a perfect storm for the anti Kyrie movement right now, because you've got the Nets playing good basketball without Kyrie, and Boston's been great so far without Kyrie. Now, again, it's not as simple as Kyrie's out of the equation, so these teams are better. But it does. I mean, look, whether it's fair or unfair, Sarah, it's going to put a lot of pressure on him when he comes back. If this team scuffles and, you know, Dinwiddie takes too much of a step back with him out of the lineup, I think there's going to be. I mean, it's New York. There's going to be some backlash. You know, when it comes to that, if this team winds up scuffling when Kyrie comes back into the mix.
But I think with any team or any group, that's a part of different guys getting used to different roles. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's a wait and see type of thing. But from my perspective, being around and how great Kyrie has been around, he's been engaged, just the way he is with the guys, how much the guys appreciate, just things that in the middle of practices, will stop, we'll talk about stuff, we'll have guys on the side do the same thing during games. And so, we'll see how it plays out on the floor. But I think oftentimes I have conversations with people about this. They're like, oh, of course you're saying that. Like you call Nets games. I'm like, well, you could look at it like that, or you could look at it like I'm actually around it and see what's happening and see what's going on. So, you know, it's going to be, you know, a feel out process, I think, to any time a player misses a significant portion of time when they come back. But yeah, that's a part of it. I think from the Nets perspective, it's more just going to be interesting for Kenny Atkinson and the staff to figure out, okay, how does this affect our rotations of guys who've been playing significant roles and have been impactful, and how do we kind of shuffle them around and move them around? And I think the big question mark will be what do you do with Spencer Dinwiddie? Leave him in the starting lineup, bring him back off the bench, and how do you utilize those two guys together?
I'd really love to be able to see into the future and see what the end result of the Nets 2020-2021 season looks like and who's still on the roster and how far they get into the playoffs. I mean, it just, the amount of things that are going to change over the next 18 months in Brooklyn is, and how it all, like, what does Kevin Durant look like coming back in that first season? How happy is he playing alongside Kyrie Irving? Because even though they're friends, they haven't played together on our team, you know, an NBA team. Ever. So I'm dying to see how this all plays out. It's one of the more fascinating teams to watch in the next 2 years.
Yeah. Really and you're right, because there's, you mentioned acclimating Kyrie and add in Caris and add in, yeah, once Kevin comes next year. So that's I think is why, you know, it really, with coaching staffs and head coaches and, for Kenny Atkinson, it's awesome problems to have when you have this type of talent and these caliber of players, but it also it makes your job, you know, a challenge, just figuring out how to make all those pieces work together. But certainly good problems and good challenges to have.
Good challenges to have, indeed. Sarah, always appreciate it.
Mannix, you're the best. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Braving the elements, like when you get into like December, January, to start thinking like maybe Los Angeles would have been better. Like maybe
it crosses your mind. It crosses your mind. I'm a Chicago girl, born and raised, you know, in the snow and the cold and the in getting all bundled up. So I get a little bit of pleasure. I always used to say when we would take road trips to cold places, that the cold, like it's good for the soul. The cold's good for the soul. But I feel like my soul is getting a little tired of the cold.
I feel like that's what people say just to get them through.
You gotta say things. You gotta say things to help yourself. But no, I don't mind it. It's good. It makes you appreciate the warm weather even more.
Yes, when that thaw first comes, it makes everything that much better. Sarah, always appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
Sounds good, Mannix.